when I finished this book, I thought, do I really want to put this out there? I mean, this is like tearing down every wall I put around myself my entire life. People didn't really know exactly who I was. I would be tearing down this whole facade and putting out the rawness of who I am as a human being.
This is Daring to Tell, the podcast where writers read their true stories of personal daring, and then we talk about writing and life. I'm your host, Michelle Rado.
Nothing's gonna make me brave. Nothing's gonna make me brave. Nothing's gonna make me brave except doing what makes me scared.
Okay, a big declaration here. Writing is magic. What I think I mean by that is writing as a creative process is magical, especially as a means of self-exploration. Because you can pick up a pen or a pencil and start writing out the story of your life. And if you can relax, get into the flow of it, and let the writing lead you where it wants to go, that's the mystical part of it. More often than not, you will end up finding yourself in places you may have never expected to go. I never get tired of hearing the ways that this creative process shows up again and again with pretty much every person I talk with on this podcast. Case in point, today's guest, Felice Boucher. Felice made a living by doing lots of jobs, but then found her, quote, voice, if you will, through photography. She ended up having an extremely successful and rewarding career in it with a lot of hard work and dedication. So Felice does not consider herself a writer, yet here she is with a memoir called The Making of a Mechanical Heart, which she started writing, I think, only about a year or two before her 73rd birthday, which is where she places us for the starting point of the story. Letters can often be the starting point for people contemplating their lives, and her original motivation was a calling to start writing in the form of a letter for her two grown kids. We'll hear more about why, but the part that I marvel at is the process, because once she started writing, she just couldn't stop. So much just started pouring out of her in telling her life story, it grew to have tentacles to include some stories that she couldn't dream of ever sharing with her children. And there it is, the paradox of memoir. That's kind of how I think about it. We feel this calling to write. If you can allow yourself the openness to let it all spill out onto the page, can we ever then dare to share it? And yet, if we do, is there magic to be had? And by magic this time, I think what I'm really suggesting is transformation. You can see what you think by the end of this conversation. One component of my talk with Felice that I absolutely loved, and which won't surprise anyone who's heard any recent episode of Daring to Tell, is that when she was in the thick of writing, she would often have a friend or two who she would read out loud to. She also had friends who then would ask her, "Read more of your story to me." This is always music to my ears because I think that there is something even more magical about writers reading their stories out loud that allows them to sort of fully blossom, come into their fullest incarnation for both the writer and the listener. To that end, I want to tell you that if you happen to hear this episode before Saturday, August 8th, and are in the vicinity of Brunswick, Maine, I will be doing a free audiobook talk with Peggy Cook about the making of her audiobook, Released, Walking from Blame and Shame into Wholeness. She as writer and narrator, me as audio producer. It's happening at Curtis Memorial Library with its new lobby freshly unveiled in Brunswick, again on Saturday, August 8th at 1 o'clock. So please come, bring a friend. We will be playing clips from her audiobook and sharing some fun outtakes and discussing not only some of the logistics that go into the making of an audiobook, but also the unique fortitude, I guess I would call it, that it takes for a writer to read their own memoir. And once again, it's often surprising and transformational effect. There is a link for that info in the show notes. But back to Felice Boucher. When I think about why The Making of a Mechanical Heart pulled me in so much, I think it might be because from the very first page, it felt as if she was talking to me. By this, I don't mean that she knew who I am, knew that I grew up in a sort of working class, in decline factory town, kind of like her. I certainly didn't relate to being a young mother of two children. I don't have any kids, nor do I know what it's like to be given a diagnosis of stage 4 cancer. But her words do feel as if she's addressing me, calling me a gentle reader, adding little asides that assure me that she is in control of how and when she will roll out an explanation for a certain bombshell she might drop into an anecdote. It's like we're meeting up for coffee and she's just telling me about her life. Her intentionality creates intimacy and even urgency. I feel she wants me to know who she is. And I feel a love and a joy in her telling of her story, where she came from, and in sharing those deeper questions into how and why we end up, where and who we are. This is also very much a Maine story. Felice was born in 1950 and raised in Lewiston, Maine, a once thriving textiles city entering a period of decline. Across the Androscoggin River, which once powered those mills, is Lewiston's sister city, Auburn, where some of my own ancestors once lived. Together, they are known as L.A., Lewiston, Auburn, and have the second largest population in our Pine Tree State after Portland. To give you a little sense of geography as well that'll come up later in our chat, she talks about commuting from where she lived in Lewiston to Portland, maybe about a 45-minute drive or so, back to Lewiston, then to the city of Bath, home of Bath Iron Works, and which has a deep maritime history, where the Kennebec River meets the Gulf of Maine, and is also about a 40-minute drive or so from Lewiston. Basically, a lot of driving. Some highways, but also smaller, windy two-lane roads. Okay, I think we're adequately prepped as I introduce you to Felice Boucher for our discussion about her memoir, The Making of a Mechanical Heart.
Thank you. I'm so honored to be here. I'm honored that you asked me to join you.
Oh, my pleasure. I am honored to have you here. I heard you at Nina Lichtenstein's salon a couple months back where you were presenting your memoir, The Making of a Mechanical Heart. And when I saw you up there and Nina introduced us, I was just riveted. I mean, the name of the book is really compelling. It's a beautiful cover. This is not a video. This is not a video podcast. I'm showing you your own cover, which you know quite well. But I think one of the other things that immediately piqued my curiosity in hearing about you and the story of your life was that you're a photographer. How different that is from my art. And I have such Like reverence. And I, for people who have a strong visual sense, I'm always very envious. I take the worst pictures, you know. I try to frame things and I try to make them beautiful, and it just doesn't happen. So I will stick in the sound realm. But
but as you know, just like with your art, post-production is important, as it is with photography and the work that you do. So it's not perfect from the get-go. I mean, it's good, but then I tweak it some.
Yeah. And that's the fun part we discussed.
It is post-production work.
What does that look like in photography? Tell me just, I would love to hear a little bit more about your background as a photographer.
Well, in my book, I mentioned too, I mean, I started in the day of film. And you had to get everything right at the get-go. So that was fabulous training. Every time I pushed that button, it had to be right. So I had to understand light. I had to understand timing. I had to understand all of it. And so I think that had a lot to do with how my work, even today, even though it's digital now, that initial film work really plays into what I do now, because mm-hmm. life is very important to me. So
can you describe that? Like what are you looking for or thinking of when you even are just approaching something in regard to light?
Well, it's so funny because I feel as if, I mean, constantly I'm looking at light. If I'm having tea or coffee with someone, or right now, the minute you came on my screen, I'm looking at the light, how it falls on your face, if you have light in your eyes. And I had a young photographer say to me several years back, she said, you know, you old timers always, it's all about the light. It's the light. She said, just take the damn photo and fix it in Photoshop. And I'm thinking, what a shame, because it's important to get light in someone's eyes. When I create a portrait, people have always said my portraits are so strong. It's because I understand light and I bring the life into those eyes by lighting them properly. Mm-hmm. So yeah, light is extremely important to photography. And there's some things you can't fix in Photoshop after.
Yes.
Just like your art too. I mean, there's, you know, you can't put in what's not there. So you have to capture it. You can take some out, you can tweak things, but overall, you have to get the basic, the important stuff in there.
Exactly. And that's what I was, you know, thinking about metaphorically with recording something with sound, because I am always listening to people. And when I go somewhere, I'm listening for people's voices and what else is around us. And I've just always been greatly influenced by sound and working in radio my whole life. I think I naturally went in that direction. But then when you go in a direction that you're sort of primed for, the nurturing, the fertilizing of what that art might be is even all the more important. So I have a friend who was a colleague from work who I worked very closely with for many years. And he always used to say, you know, it's all about getting the good audio. Because as you say, you want to get as good as it can be at the very beginning, because then you're going to do something else with it. And so he would especially say, you can't polish a turd.
Oh, I like that.
I know. And I think about that too. And I also think about, you know, Ira Glass of This American Life fame, you know, is huge in the public radio world. He said something else, though, about sound and about story and how you can have really terrible audio, but if your story is compelling, that's what people really care about.
Exactly.
And you've got a really compelling story, my friend.
Thank you. Thank you. It wasn't meant to be a book. It started out as just a letter to my children because, as you know, I have stage 4 cancer. And 3 years ago when I was diagnosed, they had given me just 8 to 12 months to live. So I wanted to, because my children always viewed me as being so tough. They would make jokes about how tough I was. And, you know, I wanted them to know why I was tough.
Yeah.
So I started to write them a letter, and then I just kept sitting down and writing more, and sitting down the next day and writing more. And then all of a sudden, it was just pouring out, and I found that I loved writing. I'm certainly not a writer. I don't want to take away that fabulous gift from real writers and authors. It's just like, just because you own a camera or a phone doesn't make you a photographer. I think, you know, people study and they learn the beautiful craft of writing, and I'm new to that world. But I think the gift that I do have is that I'm visual and I'm a fairly good storyteller. And I'm just now learning the craft of writing, and I'm enjoying it.
So you didn't take any writing classes or anything before. You
No.
just were like, this is for my children.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that is such a huge motivator for so many, especially memoir writers, to say, who am I and what do I want to leave for who comes after me, be it children or the world?
Yeah, and you know, I have so many friends who say they've always wanted to write a book. So many people have told me that. But I think when you're given a death sentence, it sort of gives you a deadline. So it gave me a reason to get up every day and to write because I had something I wanted to get down. And even when it reached a point where I decided, because some of the stories, as you know, are a little spicy, I reached a point where I did not want my children to read the book. And it wasn't meant to be a book. I was just writing it. I just had to write. And I was writing, and I wasn't thinking about, I'm writing a book. I'm writing and writing and writing and enjoying telling this story. I wasn't thinking, I'm going to write a book. I'm going to write a memoir. And I just kept writing because it felt right. It felt right, and it felt good, and I enjoyed the process, and it gave me purpose. And that's why it just continued. And friends would come over to visit me, and I would force them to listen, and I would read
Oh, I
to
love that.
them. And, you know, over and over. And I had one friend who would take me to my chemo appointments, and then I would go to her house. She's a retired nurse. I'd go to her house, and I'm like, okay, I have to read to you. And so she'd have to hear this over and over. And then I had another friend who would come over just to hear me read because she loved the stories. And the poem that I brought to her, she brought to her therapist, and she was trying to read it to her because it moved her so much and it touched her own heart and her own feelings. And she said she could barely get through reading it. She was crying so much. And she
Wow.
said, her therapist said, could you hear that? She goes, well, sort of, through the
Yeah.
started resonating with people with their childhood and their process. And
That's beautiful. I so love that you read it out loud to people as you go, because I sort of feel as this, it's one thing to put something down on the page and then having it come out of ourselves is this other part that is, it's sort of like a culmination of the creative process. Like you say, when you started writing, you were just writing and writing and writing, and you didn't have an ideation of what it would be. Or, I mean, you know, maybe that this was something for your kids, but that eventually you're like, well, I don't know, maybe they shouldn't read this. But what, like, how were you writing every single day? What, can you give me a snapshot, if you would, about, you know, that time?
I wrote every single day. It was the reason I got out of bed in the morning because it was winter time that first year and it was COVID.
Oh, God. Yeah.
I had to, with my immune system, I had to be extra, extra careful. So I had, my dog was alive then, and we would go, the two things I did was walk him and write. And I did start making my flower photographs too, but once I started writing, that was my main
Wow.
project phase. And I would rewrite and rewrite and rewrite. And I didn't know about any of the programs on your computer that would help you with spell check and all of that.
Sort of ancillary, really.
Yeah. So I was just, and I was handwriting everything.
Oh, yeah.
So in a notebook. And then I would put it on in an email. Actually, that's how I started writing, was on an email. And then that would help me a little bit with spell check. And yeah, so it was so important. It was so important to me. It got me through all the chemo and everything I had to go through. Because I would bring my notebook to my chemo appointments and write while I was there.
Were you writing, were you sort of commemorating the process of what you were
No.
going through? You were remembering.
Yeah, I was just remembering. Thinking about my childhood, thinking about things that I remembered. And, people say that my writing is so visual because I'm a photographer, but I think it's the other way around. I gave that some great thought. And I think I'm a photographer because I was so visual as a child, because people are astonished as to what I remember. I can tell you the layout of apartments, of my aunt's house, my grandparents' house, when I was 2 and 3 years old. So I think I became a photographer because I saw things visual.
Wow.
I think my writing is extremely visual because of the one gift I have, and that's seeing things visually.
Your memory is remarkable because you, I was going to say, what's your earliest memory like?
My earliest memory was an apartment my parents had on Lincoln Street in Lewiston, Maine. I can't tell you if it was the second or third floor. I think it was maybe the second. But I remember I was maybe not quite three, probably, maybe younger, dragging a chair and deciding I was going to wash dishes. And there was a sharp knife in there, and I still have a huge scar on my finger. It's a bad cut. And I had cut my finger with a knife. And yeah, I had to go to the hospital. And
That's a memory maker right there.
yeah, I was probably 2 and a half because my mother was pregnant for my brother, who's 2 years younger than me. So yeah, and I remember my mother going places. I remember my grandfather coming to babysit. I remember the layout of that apartment. And I remember my third birthday party that my mother gave me in the yard. I remember the yard. It was a square dirt yard.
Yeah, and d well, you do tell wonderful scenes too, but repopulating those memories with things like there's a lot of things you couldn't have remembered, like being a little baby in the laundry basket your mom's carrying as she goes off to the beach, and so those were stories that were told to you, I'm assuming.
Stories at the end of my mother's life, and that was the gift for her and for me, is at the very end of her life, I would sit in her kitchen right before hospice started giving her morphine, and I would ask her different things. And so my aunt, who I ended up living with, I would go visit as an adult, a young adult. And she told me a few stories. So between what my mother told me, what I remember, what my aunt told me, I was able to sort of stitch together. I mean, obviously, I don't know what my mother was thinking as we were on the bus. I just knew we took a bus. So, that's why I wrote a semi-memoir, because I make up what my mother was thinking. But yeah, my mother was a very beautiful woman, extraordinarily beautiful and very smart. And I think about, had she had the correct medical attention and support, her life would have been very different. As for many people, many children who are not given the support and care that they need, their lives would take a different turn. I remember recently at a stop sign, and this person who obviously was drugged, struggling, And I thought, you know, when that man's mother gave birth to him, she wasn't thinking, oh, geez, I hope my son's a drug addict and, you know, has a challenging life. No, I think we all have great hopes for our children. And
yeah, that's a really beautiful and a good observation. It's funny when you said that. So it made me think of this time when I was a kid. I had to have been like 6 or 7 or something. And there was a pool, like a state pool, across the street from the house where I grew up in. And there were kids there. This is minor, but it was really impactful to me. There were kids there who were kind of like town toughies. And I will say, your story of growing up in Lewiston felt very reminiscent to me of the place where I grew up, which was a small, or I shouldn't say small, like a mid-sized central Massachusetts town. Very French Canadian, Catholic, almost everyone in the town. So there was, it feels like a lot of similarity in the
environment that we both.
Exactly. The environment, you know, like a an industrial town. What am I trying to say? Like a factory town there. Anyway, so there were, you know, tough kids everywhere who I tried like the plague to stay away from because I was like a very vulnerable little girl. And so, anyways, one day at the pool, I see a couple of these boys who were maybe a year or two ahead of me, not that much ahead, but like they were older and they were tough. And I saw them smoking cigarettes and they had to have been 10, you know, or, and it like broke my heart at that age. Cause I mean, it's a similar feeling that I think what you're describing, you see someone who's in a path that's like struggling, you know, we're responding to an environment with something and it's hard. And you go, what is this about? You know, we all try and make our way through
and yeah,
responding. And that goes for us, goes for our parents, you know, that your mom struggled with mental illness later on.
Yeah.
So maybe to get us going, I know I had given you quite a list of things I would like you to read today. Sure. And I was thinking I might add even one more to it because I was looking through yet again and I thought, how can we not start at the very beginning? It is one of the best beginnings ever. It's really so. And we're very close to a special day that is coming up yet again.
I know. I can't believe it's been a year since I published this book. And
yeah,
my birthday. I can't believe I've made it to 3/4 of a century.
Well, yeah. I mean, and when you, you know, dealing with living with stage 4 cancer, as you said, for such a long time, you know.
Well, when I was first diagnosed with bladder cancer at age 41, the wonderful doctor that I had said that I would not die of bladder cancer and that it was similar to skin cancer. And as long as I stayed on top of it and as long as he stayed on top of it, I would be fine. And I was for a very long time until he retired. And the protocol for the doctor who took over from him was very different. So that got into trouble. But I have a different urologist now who is equally as wonderful as the first doctor I had. So I feel as if I'm in good hands. So I'm very fortunate.
Yes, exactly. And I mean, it's a wonderful thing to still obviously be here. But I love what you were saying about feeling motivated to get stuff down because we all have a clock on us. And I say that not being, you know, being sensitive to the fact that I know that you have dealt with this on an ongoing basis.
Yeah, no, I have many friends who say to me, you know, and I say, well, I'm facing death. And they're like, all of us are facing death. But I always remind them, I have stage 4 cancer standing behind a cliff ready to push me.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a little more, I have more of a deadline, I think, so.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But every day.
Yeah.
Okay.
Would you like to start at the beginning?
Sure. Okay. and the beauty. We write to taste life twice, in the moment and in retrospect. And I use Nin. Today is my birthday. It's been coming once a year for 73 years now, rain or shine. Whether I've celebrated with others alone, I've always looked forward to it. Just the fact that it followed the first day of summer felt wonderful. Winters are so long here in Maine that the few months of summer make it extra special. As we like to say, we have 9 months of hard winter and 3 months of darn poor sledding. Even though I have always been grateful for my life, I have taken it for granted in some ways. This year, gentle reader, sorry, I've always wanted to write gentle reader. After all, who wants a hostile reader, especially on one's birthday? I am not taking my birthday or any day for granted. Today it's raining, and I'm still grateful. 10 months ago, I was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer and given 8 to 9 months to live without treatment. After several months of challenging chemotherapy, I'm still here after extreme fatigue, the loss of half my hair, nausea, skin rashes, blisters, and needing to use my mother's old cane to walk around. But still, here I am, celebrating my birthday on this lovely rainy day. Immunotherapy treatments would give me another 3 to 5 years, but unfortunately, I'm unable to tolerate them. I was first diagnosed with bladder cancer at 41. This recent diagnosis, unfortunately, indicates that the cancer has decided it wants a new adventure and has spread to my lymph nodes. I am no longer the captain of my vessel. Pirates have climbed aboard and a new captain has taken over and is sitting at the helm. Captain Stage 4 Cancer. I'm an outlier who plans on sticking around beyond the time given to me by the experts. After all, I come from a line of damn tough Maine women. So today on this rainy day, I'm smiling. I'm grateful and I'm smitten with joy. Yeah, I have a crush on joy. Today, gentle reader, I will have a little chocolate raspberry cake and a chocolate frosting hard on top for breakfast, just because I can. Yes, my life has been challenging and filled with trials and tribulations, as it is for most of us. But parts have been pretty darn fabulous. All of it developed me into who I am. And for that, I'm grateful. I'm here to tell you when you come face to face with your mortality, the Grim Reaper, you can ignore it. You can run scared. You can get angry. You can fall apart. You can withdraw. You can embrace it or maybe experience all of it. No right or wrong here. No judgment. The road I've chosen is to look deep inside to try and understand the underbelly of who I am and why. Here's my story.
Love, love, love. I just want to recognize, oh my God, Felice, what a beautiful opening. I mean,
thank you.
I am just right there with you. Talk about a photographer's view. Today is my birthday. Here we are, and it's a snapshot of you on your birthday. On a day that you might not have been here. And
right.
And joy is such a part of you. Like, I just see you and I see joy. And I'm going to ask you to skip ahead a little bit with what we're going to read. But, you know, life starts with challenges. And I think, as you say, you can come to face, and there's every way in the world people can react to it. But I'm with you. It's like, look down under in that, like, underbelly. What the hell happened? What was under there? And try and understand it and get the context.
And the thing is, I've come to understand, too, not everyone chooses to look underneath anything.
Exactly.
You know, to believe that life is about happiness and adventures and not looking at any of it. And they choose to just, you know, reach for the gold ring all the time and not look at any of the whys. And, you know, and I think that's fine too. But for me, it's important to look underneath and understand.
Yeah, I love that. And yeah, we're all made of different stuff. And
made of different stuff and make different choices. And that's what my book is about too, is like, it's about choice and what you choose to look at and how to go forward. So
So let's hear a little bit about the family. We'll skip to page 17.
okay, the family. My parents met at a local dance hall when my mother was 16 and my father was 18. I've been told they were the absolute best dancers and the most beautiful couple there. This really stretched my imagination. I never once saw them dance together. I heard stories about how they danced all the time when they were first married as teenagers, but I didn't witness that with my own eyeballs. I don't think they even sat together ever in front of me. But then they had five kids, so somewhere and at some point, they did some sort of a dance. 8 years into their marriage, my mother called our parish priest over to the house to discuss her interest in taking birth control pills. At that point, she had three kids, me, my brother Bobby, and my brother Frankie. That was three too many in her book. I watched spit fly from the priest's mouth as he angrily yelled and pointed his stubby fat little finger in my mother's face, telling her how disappointed he was in her. The priest wouldn't even discuss it. Absolutely no Catholic woman from his church was going to take birth control pills. It was a sin against God, after all, as it was also a sin to deny her husband intimacy. Along came two more kiddos. My father, after all, was a devout Catholic. As the priest was preparing to leave, he stuck out his hand, expecting his $2 donation. My mother placed three quarters and a dime into his palm. She was not someone you crossed. I kept waiting for her to let him have it, but I guess priests were in a safety zone of some sort, a big Catholic protective bubble. I can't tell you if my father wanted kids, didn't want kids, or even liked the kids he had already. I only knew my mother didn't want more kids because I happened to be home when the priest came to visit and then overheard a phone call to her sister Rita once he left. Smoking a cigarette, pacing back and forth as far as the curly phone cord would allow her to travel, my mother shared the entire story. She wanted to knock that priest across the state line, and better still, across the border to Canada, she told my Aunt Rita. I have enough damn little rats running around in my house and don't need any more. I don't know what she said after that because she suddenly noticed me, rat number one, and she wanted to know what I was doing in the house. Get outside, she hissed at me. It's not supper time yet. I must admit that I didn't know my parents as people when I was a kid. We never had conversations or talked at all, really. Our interactions consisted of get out of the house. Go to bed. That's none of your business. And do you want me to take my belt off? I think it was the times. It wasn't any different for any of my neighborhood friends. You were kicked out of the house to play, and you went home to eat when the street lights came on. And it was not an era when parents asked their kids how they felt, their opinions, what they wanted for dinner, or what they might want to do. One day, my next door neighbor, Louise, and I were sitting at her kitchen table with her grandmother and her friend. They were having coffee and chatting. We were trying to get permission for Louise to go to the playground with me. In her attempt to get her grandmother's attention, Louise slid her hand up the sleeve of her grandmother's house dress. Louise loudly announced how horrible and yucky it felt, while her grandmother and friend ignored us. Really, Louise told me, put your hand up there. I shook my head violently and mouthed, no, thank you. You have to, you really have to, she said. Louise grabbed my hand and guided it up her grandmother's sleeve to above the elbow, where her wrinkles and droopy skin sat. I still said nothing and just wanted her to release my hand so it could find its way quickly back to my lap. I admitted to Louise as we scooted out the back door after being told to get out of the house that it certainly was yucky and cold. I wondered if that would happen to me someday, or if Louise's grandmother just had something wrong with her arm. It was also shocking to me that Louise's grandmother allowed Louise to stick her hand up her sleeve to feel her elbow. If I had even leaned against my mother, she would tell me to scoot because she had all she could do to hold herself up, never mind holding up some kid, too. I loved hanging out at Louise's house. because she had a bunch of sisters and a brother, Lenny. We'd have Miss America pageants with Lenny as the lone judge. He'd come up with the funniest things to say when one of his sisters came down the ramp, which was made from large boards lined up on the lawn. Lenny would sit in a lawn chair and at the end of the ramp with a clipboard and a pencil. As his first sister walked down the runway, he'd announce, "Here she is, Miss Georgia, a carpenter's delight, flat as a board." He never said anything horrible when I came down the ramp, but he was still funny. "Here she is, Miss Maine, cute as a Maine pine cone, sticky and prickly." My parents didn't have hobbies or read books. My father couldn't read or write anything more than his signature. I now know he had learning disabilities, and as a boy, he was pulled out of school to work with his father, who was a plumber. My father was brilliant at figuring out plumbing problems. That was his part-time job on weekends. But because he couldn't read or write, he was unable to pass the test needed for his license to work for a plumbing company or start his own business, even though he could easily figure out problems that many of the licensed plumbers struggled with and would turn to him for advice. My father was a quiet man and worked two jobs most of the time. Because of his work schedule, he rarely ate meals with us, so we didn't see much of him growing up. One early morning, when my father returned from working the night shift, old milk, he had something he wanted to tell us. I remember it was a Saturday morning, because my brothers and I were all sitting on the couch watching Bugs Bunny on TV. Since my father was a man of very few words, we all perched at the end of the couch, all ears, because we figured this had to be really good. Maybe we'd get ice cream, go to the beach, or get a bucket of spaghetti instead of our usual Saturday night baked beans. Maybe we'd even get a dog. My father looked a little tired, but he was still neat as a pin despite having worked in the mill the night before. His neatly trimmed, pencil-thin mustache had a couple of pieces of sawdust still stuck in it. And he was also still wearing his dark gray flannel flat hat, even though it was now summertime. He told us that night before he had seen a man get his arm totally ripped off by the very machine he himself worked at it every day. Blood was squirting all over the place, explaining that it was shocking that the guy was still alive. From the kitchen, my mother yelled out, "Jesus Christ, Hank, we didn't need to hear that shit." I always thought he told us that story in case he came home from work one day with only one arm. That way we wouldn't be so surprised to have a one-armed father. He worked swing shifts, 2 weeks on the first shift, 2 weeks on the second shift, and 2 weeks on the third shift, which made for a man who was always short on sleep, cranky, short-tempered, and aching to get away. The weeks that he worked nights and tried sleeping in the daytime, my mother would shush us as we ran in and out of the house. When her shushing didn't help, he would come out with his belt ready to slap the kid closest to the bedroom door. The minute we heard the bedroom door squeak open, we all headed full speed out the front door and into the woods behind our house. I'm not sure how my youngest brothers, Jeffrey and Jude, liked being left behind, but it was every kid for themselves during those times. Frankie, Bobby, and I would sit and wait in the woods until we saw our father's Nash Rambler pull out of the driveway on his way to work before we headed back into the house. The first time our father made $100 in 1 week, which included two jobs and some overtime, he lined up the family and held the $100 bill for us to look at but not touch. He walked down the line of us so we could each look closely at Benjamin Franklin. I pretended to be impressed because I could tell that was what my father wanted, but I didn't get what the excitement was all about. I gave a dazzled, "Oh," when he stood before me, which I felt did the trick. "Can Bobby and I have a nickel for the store?" I asked him. He had to strike while the iron was hot. He squeezed open his little red plastic change holder, which he carried in his front pant pocket. It mainly held assorted washes for his plumbing jobs, along with a couple of pennies and the dime he presented us. After all, we were now rich. I wonder if my father knew when he first met my mother that the lively, beautiful 16-year-old girl he was so excited to dance with had shot her best friend Rose when she was 15. Rose's parents were sure my mother had shot their daughter because she had such large, perfect breasts, and my mother was flat-chested. They told the police that very thing. Rose's parents wouldn't allow my mother to visit their daughter in the hospital, even though it was said to have been an accident that the gun went off and pierced through the side of Rose's perfect breast. After getting to know my mother, I think Rose's parents have made a wise decision. How do I know this story? Well, not because my mother told me about it. When I found out about the shooting of her best childhood friend, I asked her about it, and she denied it, flat out denied it. I know you're going to find it hard to believe, but it's the damn truth. I thought about telling you the entire story right now about my mother shooting her best friend, but I'll tell it later, so just hold on.
And that is where we must wait. I read that and my eyes were popping out of my head. I was like, oh my God, her mother shot her best friend.
But, and the way that I actually found out about it is shocking. So
listeners will have to get the book if they're curious, because we're not filling you in on that part.
To find out how she shot Rose's perfect breast.
Oh my God. It's hilarious and so poignant, I guess. Sad. I mean, your mom's attitude, holy cow.
She took no prisoners, and my husband and I, you know, I was married young, as you know from the book, and we were headed to Chicago, and my then mother-in-law was so concerned about us going to Chicago. And I'll never forget this. My mother was sitting on the front lawn in a lawn chair, and my mother-in-law was telling her how anxious she was about us leaving. And my mother just took a drag on her cigarette, blew out the smoke, and she said, "Irene, they could get hit crossing the street. Don't worry about it." That was my...
Yeah. Oh, Felice. Childhood challenges. Yeah.
We all, but some a little bit more challenging than others.
Yeah. No, it's true. And, you know, another part, which I guess we're not going to hear today, but, you know, that you spent time living with your Aunt Charlotte for a while in your early childhood, because it was a challenge for your mom taking care of everybody. But, you know, two teenagers having babies, that's tough. That's tough.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, two other things I just have to say, because there were things in this that resonated with me. I was laughing hysterically about the wobbly arm, because when I was a little girl, there was an old lady who lived next door to me, and she would read me stories and such. And I think when I got to be a little too much for my young mom, who, you know, needed to have a little time to herself, like, go visit Nana Chase. So I go next door. Nana Chase would read to me, and she would play hide the thimble. And she had this chair she sat. It was like her, you know, sort of an easy chair. I think it was leather. But it wasn't snuggly, and she had a wooden desk chair. And so I would pull up the wooden desk chair, sit next to her while she would read. And I remember, like, holding her arm and feeling that real wobbly, flabby skin. But I loved it. I was like, I'd want to squeeze it and squish it. It was like this tactile delight. And she didn't like that all that much. I mean, I don't think she minds snuggling, but she didn't like me playing with it. She'd be like, stop it, stop it. She also had the same thing as a little waddle under the chin. She didn't like me touching that one either. But, you know, you're a little kid and you're like, what is that?
Yeah. Your mother didn't have it, so you were astonished by it. Yeah.
Exactly. So now I like grab my own little arm flesh and remember my Nana Chase. Oh, God. But the other one that I have no familiarity with is a bucket of spaghetti. What? What is a bucket of spaghetti?
I talk about, we were Catholics and we couldn't eat meat on Fridays, so my father would pick up a salmon pie.
Oh, wow.
Would have salmon pie every single Friday evening.
Yeah.
I know a lot of people who love salmon pie still, but are horrified that we would add ketchup to the top. And then Saturday evenings, we had a bucket of beans.
Mm-hmm.
And Wednesdays was a bucket of spaghetti. And I loved it when my father would get that long white bread. That was like which he didn't always get because that was an extra 25 cents.
Mm-hmm. Where do you get a bucket of spaghetti? Was it just like the local?
Oh, it was a thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
There were many different places that offered it in downtown Lewiston. Yeah.
Interesting. Never heard of it. Yeah. It sounds really good. Honestly, I'm like, I would like a bucket of spaghetti.
I'll offer it. Yeah, I do.
So there's a whole bunch of stuff that makes up the middle of one's life. I think about it a lot as in young adulthood and moving on. You know, it's sort of like, okay, challenges of childhood move into challenges of adulthood and you become your own person and you're trying to figure it out. And then I think we do get this more. I have felt this, especially after health challenges that I've gone through too. You think, what is this all about? So we're going to skip through some of the middle and go to a little more contemplative stuff, I think, towards the later part, shall we say.
But what you were talking about, you reach an age where you start looking at things. But I think that I did not experience that because I was married at 17, turned 18 the next day. And then I had my first child at 20.
Yeah.
My first husband was in college and I focused on supporting us. And so I really didn't go through any of that part of really looking at myself until much later in life. Because I think I was someone who just kept my head down and would just keep going. It was survival for me.
Yeah.
Now I look back and I think, you know, did I put myself in, you know, my life could have been easier if I didn't drag two young kids for me to attend art school. So I was always putting myself in a position where it was challenging and a struggle.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't start looking at things until later in life.
And I do think that's a little bit what I was trying to suggest, so maybe it didn't come across so well, is that early adulthood, I do think you're like, you just go forward because that's the direction you go. Yeah.
But I think a lot of my more evolved friends were looking at themselves, were looking at the world in a different way. No, it was not until I went to art school living in Portland, Maine versus Lewiston, Maine.
Yeah.
That opened up a whole new part of life that I had not experienced. For the first time, people were having friendly arguments about politics, about different world events that I had not been exposed to.
Right.
The bigger picture. And so, you know, it was a huge and interesting, fascinating change for me. So I think it helped create an entirely different person.
And do you sort of mark that to art school, to the people that you met in art school? Because actually, that's an important step. Let's not overlook that. Like, getting to art school was a huge thing for you. Art was something you had always had this sort of yearning for. And I think it probably felt, I don't want to say, I don't mean frivolous came. It's not frivolous. Like, it felt like I need to take care of two kids. So.
Well, actually, when I went to, it was then Portland School of Art, now Maine College of Art. When I went there, it was not to study, it was to study graphic design.
Mm-hmm.
Because I thought with graphic design, I could provide a living for my children. And it was something that I would enjoy doing. But so it was graphic design that I went there to study because I knew there was work that I could get. And it would be work that I could afford to care for my children because I had worked part-time at a little company in Freeport, Maine, part-time, where they made maps. And so I knew if I was a graphic designer, I could get a job there
mm-hmm.
or a place similar to that. So that's
right.
What I went to school for was to become a graphic designer. And then I also thought, if not a graphic designer, I could probably teach at some school, with an art degree, I could teach art. So I figured one of those careers would allow me to take care of my children.
Mm-hmm. And then when did the love of art blossom from there?
I enjoyed art even before that. I would take occasional classes, but didn't do anything seriously with it. It wasn't in the forefront. I did a little bit of photography, not very much. But after being at the Portland School of Art for 2 years, I was really seduced by photography and had a passion for it. I loved it. I just absolutely loved it. It was magic. They gave me a scholarship, so I decided to major in photography. And I thought, well, I could teach photography in school. I could work for a magazine or a newspaper. I thought there would be practical ways I could use that.
Yeah, I think the pragmatic aspect of it is also like, okay, here's something I can do. And your kids were still young at that point?
Yes. Oh, yeah, they were young. My son was in first grade and my daughter was in third grade, which, you know, was not easy for them. We moved a lot. We didn't have money. But in some ways, their lives were so enriched because we were surrounded by the most fascinating and alive people. And they would come to our house and hang out and we'd go to openings. And it was enriching and wonderful in those ways. But we lived in poverty and we had to move quite a bit. So, you know, I mean, we were so poor. I wore socks on my hands because I couldn't afford a pair of gloves. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it was a challenge. But my children, you know, I applied for scholarships for them. They went to summer camps. L.L. Bean offered scholarships. I applied for those. They got them. I applied for music scholarships. They played musical instruments.
Wow.
But I think, you know, both my children are very artistic, very creative. I mean, my son was one of the founders, top founders of Space Gallery in Portland.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he's done amazing, amazing things in his life. And he's a fabulous, fabulous father to his two children. And my daughter is an astonishing artist and she's a painter and that's how she makes her living. She's a brilliant mind. And I think part of them being so creative out there in the world was that time being around amazing people.
Yeah.
Having a traditional childhood, so created who they are.
And what a wonderful gift to give them the love, the support of doing that and in being in those environments, because poverty is hard, but in spite of that there's still so much richness that is there. So that's a really testament to your vision and support. Your vision,
yeah,
it's sort of like we're doing this little review, because then you became a wedding photographer. Was it weddings right away or was it?
No, I started wedding I started my own photography business once my children were older.
Okay.
Because when I did start my business, I worked 7 days a week and the hours were very long. And I certainly didn't want to do that to my kids after going to college for 4 years. I wanted a 9-to-5 job. And I wanted to be there at night making dinner for them and being there for them and being home weekends. So that was my priority at that point.
Right.
So once my daughter she was living in New York and my son was ready to graduate from college and on his own, basically, I started my business then. So I was probably 47, 48.
See, to me, that's the time when you're at this sort of pause where you can say, What does make a difference to me? What do I really want to do? Like, I can pursue this photography, this art as a business, as a means, you supported yourself doing this, which is no small feat.
I did. But, you know, being self-employed in any field, and that's the thing I learned. I watched this wonderful, I think the gift I was given is the job that I had as vice president of marketing for a chain of nursing homes. I learned that it makes no difference what kind of craft you do, whether you're doing plumbing, whether you're a farmer, whether you're always a salesperson first. I don't care what you do. You're a salesperson. Then you make art. Then you raise sheep. Then you, you know, whatever thing you're doing.
Can you describe, because what do you mean by that? Like how, I mean, I think I know, but I want to hear you describe it.
Well, yeah. I mean, I wasn't a photographer first. I had to be a business person. I had to be a salesperson. I had to be able to sell my craft. That was the most important part. And that's the part that most people don't get. They think, oh, I'm really good at, you know, carving whatever or laying floors. But you can be as good as you want to be. But if you can't sell yourself, you're not going to make it. Most people think because they're really good at something, it'll just happen. Business will come to you. And it does after a while, word of mouth and whatnot. But you have to sell yourself at the beginning.
Yeah.
You have to be a salesperson. And that's hard. It's hard when you're an artist. It's hard when you have a passion for what you're doing. It's hard to step out of that and be a salesperson. It's not comfortable for me to ask for money for something I just love doing, but how else was I going to feed myself? How else was I going to pay for my studio, my equipment and everything and the assistant? And so I had to be a good business person and a salesperson. Then my craft was important.
So smart, because you're exactly right. And I think for so many creative people today, I mean, I talk with enough writers who have their book and then they go, oh, now I have to sell it. You know, that's the same story.
Yeah. I mean, and that's the one thing with me, with my memoir, I made a decision. It's not something I was going to push and market because I did it for myself. And I'm very pleased with all of it. But I feel blessed because, you know, I was invited to do the writer salon. I was invited by you to do this. My book was chosen at Oysters in Bath. So things have happened. So.
And you got an award. I saw the silver award from Bookfest.
I did. I took second place. So that was quite nice.
Very lovely.
And I omitted it because I did the cover photography for a wonderful writer, and she had won, my photograph won first place a couple of times at that competition.
Ah.
So that's the only reason I entered this, is I'm familiar with them because of that. Yeah, I'm enjoying it.
Well, let's hear a little bit of the end then, shall we?
Okay.
The end
okay.
of the book, yes.
Okay.
So to page 138.
Okay. The winner. My mother wanted my entire attention when I visited with her, every second of it. If I glanced out the window, she wanted to know, what the hell are you looking at out there, for Christ's sakes? Or if I picked up the newspaper, she'd get upset. I'd tell her I was looking up her horoscope, which delighted her. And even though I knew it was at the back of the paper, I would start at the front so I could check out the obituaries. I was of the age when my schoolmates were making frequent appearances in that section. I would also run across the street to the market to buy her lottery tickets, which she loved. One time when I handed her the ticket, she told me that if she won that day, she'd split the winnings with me. This was something new, sharing. This is one of the several times she was in hospice, and when the nurse showed up, I left to pick up a few things she wanted for my mother. When I returned with the items, the hospice nurse and my mother were returning from the market. My mother ignored me and, using her new cane, was shuffling along as fast as she could manage. I thought surely one day she'd be run over by a car, because she never once, not once, even glanced down the road to see if a car was coming. Pine Street was an extremely busy street, but she just assumed everyone would stop for her. The nurse yelled, "Tell your daughter the good news." My mother didn't look back and hurried into her apartment. She had won $100. And as she often said, "No way, man, not gonna happen," she was keeping those winnings to herself. One Sunday, her hospice doctor happened to be driving by the apartment and almost ran her over while she was booking it across the street from the market, going like a little fire engine to get home to scratch those lottery tickets. So the next morning, my mother received her walking papers from hospice. She was on that program multiple times and, like a miracle, returned to full life more than once. One early morning, I arrived at my mother's apartment to drop something off. She was sipping what I assumed was her morning coffee. I asked, "Why are you drinking a coffee through a straw?" She looked up at me in total disgust and said, "Don't be so damn ridiculous. It's not coffee, it's wine." My mother loved her wine. The cheaper, the sweeter, and the larger the bottle, the better. When my mother defrosted the freezer in her refrigerator, she would turn it off in the evening, place all the food from the fridge and the freezer on the countertop, and chisel out any leftover ice in the morning. Even the mayonnaise would sit on the counter all night and sometimes most of the next day. Then she'd return all the food to her freezer and fridge. She never became ill from the practice. No one ever ate her desserts because there was usually enough mold under there to start a penicillin farm. I didn't even allow my dog to accept food from her because it would have sent him to the emergency vet. She had the constitution of a superwoman from another planet. It took a village to care for that woman and keep her and us out of trouble. The Buddhist way. My mother didn't want to hurt me, but she was broken. Her brokenness cut into me and made me bleed. Rose Brick. I ended up spending the last 2 years of my mother's life helping care for her. You're probably wondering why, since our relationship was less than cozy. It was because of a Buddhist class I had taken on death and dying. I had a young friend, only 52 years old and the mother of two young girls. She was dying of breast cancer, so I offered to take the class with her. I enjoyed it, and I continued to take classes after the first one ended. Little did I know that I, too, would need those teachings 13 years down the road for my own journey to the end. However, that was what the teachings were about, living your life as if today were your last day. The Buddhist nun who taught the classes was smart, funny, and excellent at helping us in an amusing and disarming way to see the ways we made our lives more challenging than they need to be. In this practice, they taught us to honor our mothers because they gave us the ultimate gift, life. I'd raise my hand with a question whenever the mother subject came up. The entire class would look over at me even before I raised my hand, because they knew I'd be questioning the idea of loving our mothers no matter what. I'd always ask, but what if? However, this wonderful Buddhist nun, along with some of the other teachers, allowed me to understand myself better. The teachings I received were a gift to both my mother and me, because I could enter our relationship in a new way, with an understanding heart. It allowed me to step back a bit and not react or engage in a defensive manner. It had taken me many years to find the courage to walk away from my mother. I was in my early 30s at that point and ready to leave for our new adventure, college, and step back from my relationship with my mother. I had spent years trying to fix her, help her, but nothing changed. She would call me and tell me she needed a pack of cigarettes, pizza, or wine. I'd pile my kids into the Volkswagen and run to get whatever she needed. She loved going to consignment shops. When I took her, she would do things like look at a dozen pairs of shoes and just toss them onto the floor. I'd walk behind her, picking them up, carefully replacing them so as not to upset the store clerk. One day, I had delivered a few things that my mother had requested. My son and daughter didn't enjoy spending time with her, so they waited in the car. My mother had wrapped a gift for me. This wasn't that unusual. She would sometimes pick up a little something at a consignment shop for my brothers or me. I thanked her and jumped into the car, tossed the package to the kids in the back seat, and headed to our place. My kids ripped at the smoke-laden wrapping paper and burst out laughing. When I stopped at the traffic light, I turned around to see what was so funny. They each held the side of a huge, used woman's girdle. It filled the entire back seat of the car from one side to the other. I could barely drive. I was laughing so hard. What the hell? What message was she trying to send? Finally, one day, a friend asked, "Would you allow your mother to treat one of your children the way she treats you?" I answered, no, absolutely I would not. That was it, no more. It was not my place to try to fix her or change her. I saw her only a few times a year for several years, and even that was difficult. Through Buddhist teachings, I was able to stitch together a relationship with her. The difference was that this time I had boundaries. I told her that if she treated me badly, I wouldn't continue a relationship with her. I believe she did the best she could, despite who she was and where she came from, but our relationship was complicated and challenging, to say the least. She never once uttered the words, I love you, until I was in my late 60s, and that was after 2 entire years of my calling her almost every day and ending each conversation with, I love you. Even after visiting her, hugging her, and saying, I love you, I wouldn't hear it back. Let me tell you, it was not easy hugging her. She smelled of heavy smoke, didn't believe in bathing regularly, and didn't bother using deodorant. However, she always dressed stylishly with her finds from garage sales and secondhand stores. Finally, one day, she uttered the words, I love you, under her breath. There it was, 67 years into this deal. I wanted to say, what? What? I didn't hear you. I wish I could say it had filled me with warm Hallmark-type bubbly feelings, but zilch, nothing. I wanted to say, finally, old lady, really? Was it that hard? And give her a kick, just a little one, because she was using a cane by then. But of course I couldn't, for obvious reasons. But I had taught her how to mother in some ways, because she started telling my brothers she loved them too.
Oh, my heart breaks and feels you in that moment. I've done a little bit of Buddhist readings in my time too. And I think that that was an exemplification of coming back, like of a practice of coming back again and again.
I realized it was an amazing gift. Even though it was challenging, those last 2 years, I was working full time. At that point, I was doing real estate photography. And that also was 7 days a week. So I would have a job in Portland, and then I would drive to Lewiston every single day, check on my mother, to meet with her nurses, to get any supplies they needed, to get things that my mother needed, and to spend a few minutes. And my mother would be angry, but I would be sweeping the floor, doing this, doing that, because I had a short period. And then I would have a job in Bath that I would go to. And that was just half of my job. Well, not even half. It was less than half. Then I would come home and I had to process all those photographs.
Wow.
I would do some dashboard dining, as I called it, in my car. Mm-hmm. It was my dinner. Then I would come home and process these photographs and deliver them to the realtors by 10 p.m. that night.
Wow.
And then start the day.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it was a challenge. But even though it was a challenge for me physically, emotionally, and financially, because I spent a lot of money on my mother at that point. She had never had like a fancy coffee. She had only had, so I started picking her up coffees, going to, she loved those scratch tickets. I bring her scratch tickets, buying her other things, her diapers, or just all the things that she needed, you know, a mop to wash the floors and whatnot. Yeah, it was challenging, but I would not have changed those 2 years for anything, because I sat with her. I learned who she was as a person, and I was able to figure out who I was as a person through that whole process. So I just view it as a gift.
Yeah. Did you find that you saw parts of yourself in her through that time together?
Even though my brothers view me and my mother as being quite a bit the same, we were not at all. We were very different. I did worry when I was younger that I might also suffer from mental illness, but I have learning disabilities, but I do not suffer from mental illness. And I learned that through doctors and just studying the whole part with my mother and watching my mother and understanding her better. But I just learned more about myself. I didn't see myself and my mother because we're so different. The way she treated her children, the way I treat my children, the way I view the world, the way she views the world. We're totally different. And that's something I learned. But it was really what helped me get through that were my Buddhist practices, because I saw her in a different way. And I could accept how she saw the world and how she had navigated through it. And, you know, I learned we all do the best we can. And, you know, her mother gave birth to 18 children.
I know.
13 of them lived. And they grew up on a farm, and those children were raised like animals. They would talk about no hugging, no I love you, no, I mean, I think each generation was a little better. I mean, I had it a little better than my mother, and my children had it better, and my grandchildren certainly have it a lot better. But yeah, it was interesting, and I'm thankful for the Buddhist practices and the teachings that I had gone through at that point in my life.
Yeah, that's very interesting. It was classes on death and dying. And I'm also wondering, like, you talk about the mechanical heart. And so we can see how the upbringing of no hugging and no I love yous puts you into this very mechanical space. But that's not who you are. I mean, and I don't know you that well at all, but I see a very warm, loving person. And was it the time sitting with her? Like, what were these two things going on doing for you?
Well, you know, I had mentioned before where my life was about surviving most of the time. So I had to shut down. I had to shut down to take care of two kids. I had to shut down to do the work that I did when I ran my own business. Being a wedding photographer, I had to shut down. You know, I couldn't be tired. I couldn't be cold. I couldn't be hungry. I couldn't be any of those things. I had to be on and I had to be there because that was one of the most important days in these people's lives. So from a young age, even up into adulthood, I shut down. And so I really thought about my heart and how it was from the song Beth Hart, H-A-R-T, who has a song about a mechanical heart. And I started really thinking about all of that, my mechanical heart. But that's how I was very different than my mother, is I do have more of a warmth than my mother had. Although my mother was so funny. But growing up, people would talk about how funny my mother was. But as her kids, we didn't think she was funny. Just like, I think my kids know I have a good sense of humor, but my friends think I'm much funnier than my kids did, you know. Like, I remember telling a story to my daughter that a friend and I, when our kids would leave to go to their friends' homes, we'd be like, bye, be home for dinner. But our dogs, if someone wanted to watch them, it's like, well, who exactly will be watching them? Will you have them on a leash? And I told that to my daughter, and she goes, is that supposed to be funny? So, you know, so my daughter... But now as an adult, I think she's funny. yeah. So I have warmth that is different than my mother's personality. And I do have, I see that my personality is different than even the way I viewed myself and how the world views me and how I view myself are different.
Yeah. One of my big questions that I was thinking about you, because I have these big questions for myself that I think about all the time. So I love to ask the people who are writing about themselves about how a lifetime can be spent rebounding from a difficult childhood. It's sort of like an energy moves forward and there's this shutting down, but then there's an opening up again. And I just wonder if you have found that or if that resonates with you in any way.
I don't know. It's like growing up, I really didn't think I was in a bad situation at all.
Yeah.
I didn't.
Yeah. No, I get that. I don't want to make it seem like, oh, it was awful, you know,
I about that. You know, it's not until I was an adult that I looked back and I thought, oh, okay, now this makes sense. It's like I'm able to put pieces in my puzzle where I couldn't before. And it was, oh, okay, now as I was writing this book, it also helped me understand. It's like, oh, this is why I do this. This is why I hold people at arm's length. I'm afraid for people to get close to me to see that, you know, because they view me as one way, and I feel like they don't really know who I am. And if they knew who I was, they'd feel differently about me. And I now understand, because it was from just the experience I had as a child. So, yeah, it does make a difference in the way you're putting the puzzle of your life together.
Did you have any different perspective overall when you started just scribbling versus when you really came to your fully finished manuscript ready to go? What was that mental? What was the change or something? What ha did something
Well,
happen there?
it was two things. It was a couple of things. You know, it felt good to finish it. It was sort of a relief in some ways. And then I also had a feeling like I've always been a very quiet person. I mean, for weddings, it changed my personality. I had to be on. I had never liked to be the focus of attention. I didn't like to be in the front of people. I was very quiet. I was a watcher, and I liked behind the scenes things. So, being a wedding photographer, I had to be in the front. I had to be in control. I had to control huge groups of people and events. And so it changed my personality. And so when I finished this book, I thought, do I really want to put this out there? I mean, this is like tearing down every wall I put around myself my entire life. People didn't really know exactly who I was. I would be tearing down this whole facade and putting out the rawness of who I am as a human being. Do I really want to do that? Is that what I want? Or do I want the stage as is with the facade in place and not let anyone know? You know, so I was faced with that. And I do have some friends in my life, good friends, who have maybe they've read the book, but they have said zero to me. They have said nothing to me. So it's interesting. You know, that part of it, I find that interesting. And I don't know what to make of it. And I've chosen to just let that go. We all take in things differently. Maybe they're shocked. I don't know. Or maybe they didn't even read it. They felt like they didn't want to see me in a different way, hold me, our relationship in a different way. So, but I think it's a big step. I would imagine it's so for other people who've written their memoirs and written about their lives. And
Absolutely. I mean, has there been other feedback that you've gotten that was expected, pleasant, unpleasant, anything?
the most shocking part of it is I have received the most beautiful letters and cards and emails and texts and gifts from people. That astonished me. And people reaching out, like there's a man who I admire greatly in the art community, and he wrote me two beautiful letters. And he's very intelligent, very important artist. And he said that in his studio, he has a small pile of books that have been over his lifetime the most important books in his life. He said when he finishes the book, he passes it on. He doesn't hold on to it. But he has a select few in his office, on his desk, that are important. And he wrote to me that my book is there. Almost made me cry again.
Yeah, that's really
You know,
That's really impactful.
About his childhood, it made him think about life choices. It made him think about his life now. It made him think about his children. It just opened up so much for him. So receiving letters like that and feedback like that has been, and I had a lot of people who reached out and started telling me their stories too, tell me about their childhood, started telling me about their lives. And then I've heard from people from many years ago. I've heard from a lot of people that I didn't know. I received a card. I was cleaning my desk up and just found it, and it opens with, "I'm your fan. This is my first fan letter I've ever sent." She's going through cancer. She's writing her memoir, and she just wrote so much to me that was so beautiful. And I feel like sharing my book has been worth it. Has been worth it.
Wow, that's huge. That's really huge. Those are beautiful stories.
Yeah, I mean, I have beautiful letters and cards here from people, emails, and so.
What was the hardest thing to put out? What was the hardest thing to write in writing this book?
Almost all of it, really. Almost all of it. When I was writing it, it wasn't hard. It just flowed out of me. But when I sat there with it, is this something I want to publish? Is this something I want to share? But, it was at the encouragement of a few friends. This one friend who comes, she still comes. I'm working on another book now, a novel, and she's coming tomorrow. She goes, "Can I come? Can you read to me?" So it's people like that who encouraged me. And when I really thought about it, I thought, if I only have a few months to live, why not share this? Why not share this?
I'm so glad you did. It's beautiful. And I mean, when you're saying all this, and I'm looking at this cover, it's a picture of you
Protecting myself.
protecting yourself, but bare naked, at least what we can see from, ribs up. But you're protecting yourself, and the look on your face is fierce and beautiful and proud and determined. I mean, there's so much in your face. Did you take this picture?
No, one of my good friends, we're still friends today, who I met at art school. And it's funny because she was a single mother going to art school. I was a single mother, and someone suggested we meet. So I sought her out. And the funny thing is, she too is from Lewiston and lived not that far from me, but we didn't know each other. And we became friends there, and we became best of friends. And she ended up leaving. She met someone and got married and left art school. But we maintained a friendship and we're still friends today. But when she was in art school, she had to do a photography project. And she asked me if I, pose for her. And she came over to my house. And yeah, we did this project. And I don't know if I should share this, but I'm going to. But yeah, she brought a joint and we got high. We had a fabulous time.
Wow. It is stunning. I mean, it's just stunning.
I think it, like you said, thank you for noticing that. It's interesting that it's both protective and open because I am naked, but yet I'm protecting myself. And so, yeah,
How old
thank
were
you.
you here?
I was 32,
Yeah.
maybe.
So young kids.
Yeah, I had been, we were living in Old Orchard Beach in the wintertime. The hotels and motels closed down, but some of them are insulated. And I rented one because no one would rent to me in Portland because I had two children and
Oh,
was,
God.
so I was looking for a place to live.
Wow. My other question has to do with your health now, and are you, how do you feel? How do you feel right now? How are you doing?
I feel actually right now I'm feeling pretty good, and knock on wood, I'm feeling good. My last treatment was, I started in September and I finished in December, and I'll go again, I think July. I'll have CT scans. But I try not to focus on that. I try to focus on the time that I can enjoy now.
Yeah.
The closer we get, it'll be more difficult for me to focus on just the moment, because then I start thinking, oh God, you know, my mind's just going, what will I do? You know, instead of writing my book, I should be cleaning out things. And yeah.
Yeah. Well, that makes so much sense. And if I can be bold enough to say, I mean, I think that I feel that it fuels you in exactly the right way. And to do what's the most important thing to do today that makes a difference?
That's one of the things that I learned from Buddhism the very first day. The Buddhist nun passed around pieces of paper, and on it, it said, you have one day to live, you have 6 months to live. And so she wanted us to say, how would we live the rest of our lives? And she said the answer was as if you're dying today, whether you have one day left to live or 50 years left to live. You live today as if it was the end, and you do what's most important for that day. And that was a really good lesson, because I tend to be someone who prepares all the time. You can ask my kids. I make them crazy. But I'm always looking ahead, getting ready for something. And I have to work at just enjoying today, enjoying what today has to offer. And, you know, I have to do a little bit of preparing, because I want things to be in place, because I know it tears people apart after someone's gone. So I want to make sure that the important things are taken care of, so that my children continue having a fabulous, that my death doesn't tear them apart. I want it to bring them closer together. So
beautiful. I mean, that's just so, again, poignant. And I feel like a tough as nails Maine woman, mom, artist, a beautiful book in such a really important and impressive project. And I'm so glad that you came into my life, Felice. It's so great to talk with you.
Oh, I'm so grateful to have met you and your lovely husband. And it's such an honor, like I said, that you invited me to be on your program. So thank you so much for that. Thank you.
Oh, I am so glad you stuck around to hear that ending. I am just so humbled by her story and her openness and really wrestling with that scary risk of sharing ourselves, just like the cover of her book. This is no hands over breasts kind of tantalizing magazine cover picture. Fierce is the word I keep coming back to. Fierce, maybe I'd even also say daring and brave and beautiful and guarded yet confident. Protecting herself, as she said, with this assertive self-hug. It's kind of like she is being the parent that she herself needed, perhaps, with that loving and protective self-embrace. Well, thank you, Felice Boucher, for this really wonderful conversation. You, my friend, definitely need to check out Felice's website, where you can see a lot more of her photography, as well as get a copy of her memoir, The Making of a Mechanical Heart. Her website is FeliceBoucherPhotography.com. I think it's .com. Yes. So FeliceBoucherPhotography.com. And you can get that link in the show notes as well. A reminder about that free audiobook talk I am doing that is happening very soon after the posting of this very episode. It's going to be Saturday, August 8th at 1 o'clock. It'll be on the southern midcoast of Maine in Brunswick's Curtis Memorial Library, which is on Pleasant Street. We'll talk about the making of Peggy Cook's audiobook, which is now available. It is called, once again, Released, Walking from Blame and Shame into Wholeness. We will talk about the logistics as well as the emotional impact and power of author-narrated memoir. You can check out the details on my website, michellerado.com, where you can also get a new little freebie from me, which is the 5 audiobooks that hooked me on author-narrated memoir. So maybe you'll want to check that out, too. My thanks this week to my street team volunteer, who has been helping me post flyers about the upcoming event with Peggy. He also happens to be my musician husband, Phil Rado, who is responsible for all of the music you hear on this podcast. I like picking out a song of his that I think works well with each of the episodes that I do. I know I've used this song before called Days, but maybe you don't mind hearing it again. I know I never mind hearing it again. Most of all, my thanks to you for making it all the way to the end and for daring to listen. I'll catch you next time.
People change. Days turn into other days. Turn into different days with the rhythm of another place. You try to earn your wings and you embrace the ancient things. The days they don't remain. And I'm well on my way, I'm well down the road to where I was before I was born. And it's not the end, and it brings me peace, it gives me hope that I'll just start again. And life is out for blood when the blood still runs, and we cry when the well runs dry. It'll change. Days turn into other days. They turn into different days with the rhythm of the falling rain. We're treading water, and we're running in place. We're trying to do the same old thing. Days they'll change. Life is out for blood. When the blood still runs, and we cry, when the well runs dry. Faces change, and days turn into other days. They turn into different days with the rhythm of another place. We are dancing, we are living, and throughout our days, change.